When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I would like to welcome you back to the podcast. This is Real Talk, and I am your host, Zuby. Today, we've got a special guest. We've got my man, Bobby Dino, who's got an interesting story and perspective to share with us all today. So, Bobby, welcome to the podcast, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Zuby. It's a pleasure.
You're very welcome. So why don't you introduce yourself? Tell the people a little bit about you.
Sure. My name is Bobby Dino. I am known on Twitter for being a author, and a little bit more in depth to that is what I write about, which is experiences that I have had from my past being incarcerated. When I was a kid, I got into some trouble. Was running with the wrong crowd, not really thinking about my actions or taking responsibility for anything. I ended up hurting someone and going to prison for it. While I was in prison, I got in more trouble and made my time longer. And I eventually had an epiphany of sorts, a self-realization that if I kept going on this path, it was just going to lead me to my death or being in prison forever. So I started turning my life around, made a conscious effort to change the way I acted and who I was, and started sharing my story with others. People found it inspirational, and here I am today.
That's awesome, man. That sounds really positive. So if you don't mind, can we take it a little back? So where are you from? Where did you grow up? What was your childhood like?
So I'm born and raised in California. There's a place in California called Anaheim, which is where Disneyland's at, and that's where I was born and raised.
Home of the Mighty Ducks.
Yeah, the Mighty Ducks are over there too. Yeah. So I grew up there. My father actually died before I was born in some kind of freak accident. My mother was pregnant with me, but she was a young girl that had a bunch of undiagnosed mental health issues. So right from the start, it was just a very tumultuous kind of bad existence, and it didn't really help in the nurture stage of bringing me towards greatness as an adult. So there were some uphill battles as a kid, and I mean, there were moments of happiness. I had my grandparents who loved and cared about me and taught me a lot of good lessons in life. But when I think back on my childhood, it's there's patches almost that seem like they're missing sometimes. And I think the reason that is because I just rather forget it.
Gotcha.
It's something that is just not and that doesn't mean that I can't discuss it or that I'm, you know, it causes me some type of physical pain or mental anguish. It's just that it's not the greatest time to remember, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what were you like as a kid when you were in school, all that? What was that experience like for you?
Well, I think when I was a kid growing up, you know, preteen years, it was the 80s, like the early 80s. And I didn't become a teenager until 90, I think. So so part of the things that are very commonplace today that the diagnoses we tend to throw on people were either unheard of or brand new back then. One of them being ADD, for ADHD. Okay. That was a term that had been coined, but nobody really bought it. It was okay. Just like, it was, they thought it was kind of a BS diagnosis. So I was diagnosed with that from a young kid and with the ADD. So a lot of my childhood was kind of spent bouncing back and forth between things, like not really a lot of being steered in good directions to where I could focus that energy for good. A lot of that didn't happen until later. So it was just me being a crazy kid for the most part.
Yeah.
until my later teen years. Yeah.
Okay. Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, I'm the oldest out of five kids.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, they're all, because of my father being deceased, you know, they're all half brother and sister.
Gotcha.
And it's kind of a complicated relationship between my mother and I and the new family she wanted to start versus what was kind of left in her past being me, which was why I lived with my grandparents. So I did have a relationship with my brothers and sisters, but it's not necessarily typical of what you would think a relationship, like we didn't grow up together.
I understand
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
They knew me as their older brother, but it's not like I was, you know, their older brother, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I understand, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so. You touched at the beginning about, getting into some trouble when you were a young man. Can you go into a little bit more detail about what happened? You don't need to, you know, if you don't want to.
Sure.
It doesn't need to be the nitty gritty, but you know, how old you were, how it sort of came about.
Sure. When I was a freshman in high school, I started playing guitar and I had already been singing. And so I got into bands, right. And kind of got this, quasi fame, you know, in my area. And so it led to this kind of a hedonistic lifestyle because I was really living unchecked to where I just thought I could do anything and laws didn't apply to me and rules didn't apply to me because I was the star and everybody kissed my ass anyway. Mm. So what ended up happening, or kissed my rear end rather. So what ended up happening was I continued to just not follow rules, not pay attention to any type of law, any type of anything. And one day I got in an altercation with someone while I was under the influence of some drugs. Mm. And during this altercation, an innocent bystander was hurt by me.
Okay. Sure.
Someone that had nothing to do with the altercation. It was someone that was an innocent because of my reckless behavior and because of like the reckless choices that I was making. Now I had just seriously caused some harm and some turmoil in somebody's life that was totally unneeded. And by extension of that, people that I hadn't even met, you know, people that I had no idea of whatever, because, you know, family,
of course,
it's a circle, it's a ripple that goes out. Right.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting in trouble for that and still not learning a lesson. Mm. So then I go to prison and I think, uh-oh. And by the way, in prison, I don't know how it is in other countries, but in California, the prison system is very racial. So not necessarily like it's set up like that by staff per se, by administration, but among the inmates or convicts, everything is race. Everything.
Sure.
And I mean to an extreme that I had never experienced in my life before. That was probably the biggest eye opener when I went. I went in there and I thought, I got to run around with the white guys and do whatever they're going to tell me or else I'm going to get hurt. Right. Mm. So that's what I did. I don't want to say I was a kid because I had just turned 23. So I was a man. I was just a young man. I ran around with them and did all types of bad and enforced rules and ended up getting more time. So now that I'm in prison, I get more time added on top of my time. So I'd gone to prison with 5 years and now had turned it into 11.
Okay. Right? So yeah. it was going to be 5 to begin with.
It was just 5 to begin with. Right.
Okay.
And while I was in there, I got another 6 added on.
Okay.
So yeah. So it after that had happened, there was a little bit of, you say depression, but what it was is me feeling bad for the circumstances I'd created for myself.
Yeah.
And then I kind of, you know, was doing some soul searching and I started adding self-help books into my reading itinerary. Cause I read about 2 or 3 books a week while I was in there. I mean, I just was constantly reading. And from reading that, I started realizing like, whoa, man, you got a lot of error in your life. And I came to the conclusion that I had to flip it. I had to do something.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
How far in were you when you had that sort of epiphany or realization, would you say?
I was about halfway. I was about five years in.
Okay.
Yeah. And the scary part, and I talk about this, not in the book that I'm releasing. I'm working on a memoir and I talk about, there's a chapter in my memoir on this. But the scary part was people don't like apostates in prison. When you have the rules that you go by and you have things that are set up like, hey, you're not allowed to do this. Don't do this. Don't do that. And then you have someone that says forget that. I'm not doing any of that stuff. They're looked on kindly. You know, they're an outlier that needs to be dealt with.
Gotcha.
But that's essentially what I had to do, because in my mind, I had come to the conclusion that I was dead already. It was just one was going to happen more quickly than the other. So either I had to quit running around with these guys and be my own man and live my own life to where I was going to be a success, or I was just going to end up dying there. So I had to call a meeting with the whites. I had to go get it. He was my shot caller at the time too, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But had to ask him, hey, I'd like a meeting called. This is what I'd like to do. This guy knew me for some years already. And he was just kind of like, whoa, you sure you want to do that? You know? And I said, yeah, I got to do what I got to do.
Yeah.
And I went to the meeting and there was, even though there was more than 30 in the building at the time, it was probably about 30 white guys that showed up. And, mm-hmm. and I just told them all, I said, hey, I got to live my life. I got to do what I have to do to be a success. I'm not going to follow anybody else's orders and live anybody else's program. I'm going to do my own program. And if anybody's got anything to say about it, let's go get it over with right now.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, like I said earlier, it was either I was going to die there or I just die later. So
yeah,
I just had to make my move, and God had his hand on me because I came out the other end. All right. So,
yeah. How did the people, the other members of your group at the time, how did they respond to that?
Immediately, someone started to speak up. And that's what prompted the, we can go handle it right now if anybody's got a, because there were a couple of the youngsters that were like, oh, you know, it's always the youngsters. The old guys are usually a little bit more mellow. It's the young guys that, you know, want to cause the havoc. But immediately it was accepted. For the long term, it made me somewhat of an outcast. I was looked on by my own people as a race traitor, and not even to say I was looked like another race wouldn't even be accurate, because I was actually kind of less than another race, because at least the other races were sticking with their own, you know. So there were people that were following the prison life mentality, that weren't too appreciative of that. However, what I had done actually prompted a few other guys down the line to follow my lead. So there was that, to where it was like, well, hey, if it's helping other people and helping out with them, that's great too. But it was definitely it was scary in the sense that, I mean, you never really know what's going to happen in prison anyway, but when I threw that into the mix, it was just, I was worried for my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I am very curious about what your experience in there was like, you know, because thank God I've never experienced it.
Sure.
But it's one of those things where I think everybody has an image of it in their imagination, whether it's from movies or documentaries or books or whatever. You know that most of those things are going to be based on reality and based on the truth, but you never know how much of it is exaggeration or fabricated to make a better story and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I mean, what you just said there about it being, being very racially divided. So that's something I've heard of from a lot of sources. I mean, you see it in films. You've got, you know, the Hispanic gangs, you've got the black gangs, you've got the white gangs, and it seems that people do split along those racial lines, not even just in America. It seems like that on a global level, as far as I'm aware. But yeah, I mean, just in terms of the, I mean, you were in there for a long time. Like, what was your routine like? How was it like dealing with the other prisoners, the guards, all that, just all that kind of stuff?
Dealing with other guards, like when it came to, like, they call them COs, corrections officers, mm-hmm. Dealing with those guys, you didn't want to deal with those guys. If you ever did have to deal with those guys, you try to bring someone with you so that they could be the second to say, oh, he wasn't snitching right now, he was just saying this or that or whatever. You didn't want to be seen talking to cops. And another thing too, why you didn't want to deal with the cops in there is because they were just as bad, if not worse, than the convicts. They used to do like gladiator fights. Like you take one gang member and a different gang member, and then you throw them on the yard. They had this big thing. You can actually research it, and anybody listening can actually research it as well. In California, they called it the Green Wall. And they called it the Green Wall because the COs wear green jumpsuits to work.
Okay.
And it was the Green Wall because when people were trying to investigate it, they all, you know how cops are, they stick together, you know? And so so it was really tough to kind of crack the badness that was going on. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is that there was a lot of corruption going on with them too. So you wanted to stay away from them. You didn't want to get on their radar, so to speak. Other convicts, believe it or not, it's not something to where everybody's trying to out tough guy everybody else. People are actually very respectful of each other, respectful of each other's space. You know, let's say you bump into someone. Oh, excuse me, you know, it's a respectful thing. And part of that is because you don't know who you're dealing with. I mean, you are in a place to where it is the worst of the worst that society has to offer.
Yeah.
So you want to be careful. But for the most part, as far as my particular routine went, I'd wake up, usually got up pretty early, do some reading, go to chow with like a breakfast chow or whatever, go do some working out after then. I did have you get jobs in there. They only pay you like 5 cents or 10 cents an hour, but you get a job. And I had a clerk's position. So I'd go and do my clerking. I mean, it becomes very much like Groundhog Day. I also had an acoustic guitar. I would play guitar.
Okay.
Kind of pass the time, reading and playing guitar. But it becomes very much like that Bill Murray movie, Groundhog Day. Are you familiar with that movie?
I'm familiar with the concept. I haven't seen it, but I know the concept.
Yeah, he wakes up and every day the alarm goes off. It starts with the same song that was playing. It's just the same day over and over. And that's a lot like what it was. The movies don't really get it right. I've yet to see a movie that's nailed it. When you see stuff like fight scenes or riots or any, none of that is like how it looks on movies. That's not. It's all. I don't wish it on anyone either.
Sure, of course. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No, I would be surprised. Yeah. So I guess two questions. What did you personally find the most challenging or most arduous thing to deal with there? And then two, what kept you positive? What kept you motivated? I mean, it sounds like obviously you were one of the rare people who made that personal decision and took that responsibility, like, okay, you know what? This is not what I want for my life. I'm going to make a change. I'm going to make sure I get out of here. I don't want to die in this place. I want to go on and do something positive and rebuild my life. So I guess, number one, what was the biggest challenge? And then number two, what was the North Star, shall we say, that kept you positive?
I like that. The North Star, Polaris. Yeah. So the biggest challenge for me in there was staying safe. It's an area to where, like I said, you don't know what's going to happen. Things can happen that are out of your control. Riots can happen. You've always kind of have to have your head on a swivel, so to speak. I found that the hypervigilance that one had to maintain while you're in there, at least if you wanted to be safe. Don't get me wrong, that not everybody was like me or like others. You know, there are some that went in there and they didn't want to work out at all, and they stayed sloppy, you know, or big, or they never looked, or they didn't pay attention. And those were the guys that were usually victimized.
Okay.
So yeah, it was like, I didn't, you know, I'm not going to be one of those guys.
Sure.
That was difficult. I would say right up there with that difficultness was the limiting factor that the racial divide put on the way that I interacted with people.
Okay.
I didn't like that I couldn't not talk to somebody, or that you and I couldn't talk because other people would frown on it. Like, I don't care, you know, and that's not, and it was very weird because Orange County, even though it's known as kind of being a conservative county in Southern California, it's very liberal with like its performing arts department. And I mean, there were kids in my school that were gay and out, you know, when I was growing up. There was all the different type of ethnicities. And for those of you who are living now and going, oh, gay and out, during the early 90s, it still wasn't cool to be a guy and be gay and out with it. I mean, it was one of those places to where it was like, man, it was cool. So going from that type of environment and then going to, that was super difficult for me because I just wasn't used to, I'm more of a content of the character type guy, you know what
as we all should be.
And people, when you don't really think about that or meditate on that, it's really something that'll kind of trip you out when it's forced on you. So that was definitely difficult, but staying alive, it takes the cake. Strenuous or stressful situations.
That sounds like that does sound stressful. I mean, that's if there's a number one priority in anyone's life that can stress them, then that's going to be it.
Yeah. You know, and as far as staying positive, for me, I knew there was never a question in my mind like, oh, I need to kill myself now or something like that. That was never something that was, because I've always known that doesn't solve anything. You know?
No.
The thing that kept me positive was that I knew that what I had upstairs and what I was learning and what I was going towards, that couldn't be taken from me. I knew it would be over. I knew that if, as long as I just kept putting one foot in front of the other, like I would make it.
Yeah.
And having that kind of knowledge and that faith in yourself, I guess, I had faith in myself. That probably helped a lot too.
Okay, man. No, that sounds positive. I want to move on to some much more positive stuff in a second.
Sure.
I don't want to stay on the past forever, man. One thing I am curious though about is why, I don't know if you can answer this question, but why do you think it is that in a place like prison, people fall back on these racial categories and divisions again? Do you think it's just the natural tribalism of people?
I think tribalism's got a huge, huge thing to do with it. But I think part of it too is it makes it easier for people to identify, which falls back on tribalism, but being able to identify your squad, your team, so to speak, especially like if there's a war, it's real easy to tell who's white and who's Mexican or who's white and who's black, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that there's some of that too, but it's definitely a tribalism thing. It's people understanding you and you know, I had this guy that I was friends with. He was a black guy. He was a lifer, but he's there for murder. His name was Al. And this guy was such a trip in like what he knew. Okay. Mm. And he was smart, but he was a hustler. Like the dude was a hustler on the street, you know, but just hustler. But he and I would have these conversations sometimes because of how he had been. For him, the racial divide didn't start in prison.
Okay.
And I can speak on this growing up in Southern California, but there's areas like Watts and Compton and areas down there that are known to be predominantly like black neighborhoods and maybe. And that's where the real racial divide starts
Gotcha. So it's already there, and
right.
then it gets amplified. And I guess it's the most low resolution category, I guess, that you can group people into. If you could
right.
just look at her, you can look in a room and you can be like, okay, how much yeah. melanin's everyone got? You can be like, okay, cool. You're the, yeah, it's,
exactly.
it's silly. It's one of the things that I find most, pesky and annoying, even in the modern day world. Of course, you know, racism is at an all time low, really. Which I think everybody should be grateful for. But sometimes when people try to almost like bring it back into the conversation unnecessarily, I'm kind of like, look, can't we just move on past this?
Yeah.
Like it's so low resolution. It's like you were talking about content of character. I don't know. I find it so bizarre and silly. In some way, it's not like surprising that people still latch onto it to some degree. And I guess
right.
to some degree, it's not like, it's not all negative, mm-hmm. but when people, it's one of those things that can easily go too far. And as soon as people start dividing and categorizing again, it's just like, oh, like we're going in reverse. Like what's the point of this? Like,
right.
I just
and,
don't.
And there's nothing wrong with like, if you think somebody has similar experiences as you, right.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with wanting to hook up with that person or wanting to
no.
hang out with that person. I mean, look, people that come out of wars, right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how biker gangs started.
That's
you
true.
Know, you know, these guys, they came back from war. They wanted to hang out with each other, you know, feel that brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's nothing or there's anything wrong with trying to find somebody who shares similar experiences. I think that when you start to define yourself by outside factors instead of what's going on by the inside, that's where you're just, and that's whatever outside factor.
That's
like,
true. Yeah.
Like whether it's your skin color, whether mm-hmm. it's where you believe heaven is, what political divide you want to fall on,
mm-hmm.
any of that. If you start identifying yourself by outside ideals instead
yeah.
of by inside character or honor, you're doomed.
Yeah, it's true. And you can't have an in-group without having an out-group. So if you think it's true. I mean, if you think, okay,
yeah.
this is my in-group and mm-hmm. I identify specifically as this and I want to associate with people who are this,
mm-hmm.
then that means that everybody else, who's normally going to be the majority, you're going to typically look down on in some way, shape, or form. And
yeah,
that's not good. You know, we can't get rid of labels and categories completely, and I don't think we would want to. But again, it's a fine line between being sane and
mm-hmm.
doing it in a good way versus falling back into, you know, fighting over dumb crap, basically.
Oh, for sure.
And,
you know, one of the things that was very liberating, and I should mention this earlier when we spoke about when I had to go to the whites, they call themselves the woods inside.
Okay.
In prison, it's short for Peckerwood.
Okay.
So,
okay.
So whites are known as woods. So,
okay.
So when I had the meeting with the woods and, did that, it was scary. Don't get me wrong. And there was this intense, period of time over probably a good couple weeks to where it was the most anxious and on edge I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just sure there was a knife coming for me. You know what
yeah.
I mean? It was just, but that being said, once I made the move to free myself from them and was free, I could talk to Al anytime I wanted.
Okay.
I could go if I wanted to work out, you know, or I speak Spanish. Okay. So if I want
okay,
to
cool.
practice my Spanish with the Mexican guys, I could go sit with them and watch Spanish TV with them and have a drink off of one of their cups of coffee or something like that, because I wasn't bound by anybody's rules anymore.
Yeah,
so
I
guess if there's a lesson that I can kind of impart by that is even something that's super duper scary, that is a blind leap of faith kind of
mm-hmm.
can have these rewards that you wouldn't have even imagined and just completely free you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, they do say the truth will set you free. And I think that, you know, telling the truth and being honest is, I think it's one of the strongest things a person can do. If you know, okay, this is genuine what I'm feeling. This is where my head's at. This is where my heart's at. And you tell the truth. I do feel like, you know, I believe in God myself. I must feel like God will protect you in
mm-hmm.
those moments from
right.
whatever harm could come from telling the truth. You
right.
know, you'll typically be protected, at least in the long term. Sometimes in the short term, it might seem like, ooh, maybe
yeah.
I shouldn't have said that. But then in the long term, it seems like these things always work out.
Martyrs, martyrs aren't made by speaking falsehoods.
No.
You know, saints, you don't become a saint by telling lies, you know. So yeah, that's definitely, I agree with that as well. I agree that whether it's in that moment or if it's somewhere down the line, that if you're being honorable, have that integrity, speak the truth, that God will put his hand on you. I do
believe that. So let's move on. Let's move on past that. So mm-hmm. how old were you when you came out of prison?
So I turned 33 that year. So I was 32 still, but a few months later I turned 33.
Okay. What was your first move, I guess?
So before I came home, part of what I would recommend to anybody, the flying by the seat of the pants thing is usually never a good thing. You want to plan. And what I did was I had planned before I came, I'd come home while I was still in there. I got into like vocational welding, did a few college courses, got in contact with some relatives that were in a union, a type of construction union. And I recommend that for people with records, because unions, especially construction, they don't care if you got a record or not. They just want you to show up and work. I went that route. And when I first got out, it was going to my place of residence, which I had already established, spending a little bit of time with my then girlfriend, but now wife.
Yeah.
and just making sure things were in line. I didn't want to spend a lot of time. I know it seems like, you know, oh man, you were behind bars for 10 years. You go on a vacation and go do this and go do that. But for me, it was like I had a plan set up and I wanted to step into that plan so there wasn't any kind of weird deviation. Because as much as I had planned for coming home was a shock.
It must be. I mean, 10 years in any place is a long time.
Yeah.
And so coming back, there must be, I mean, even just the way that the world would have changed.
Yeah. No.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how much access to technology and internet and all that stuff you have inside, but I'd imagine just coming out and just seeing the world again, everything would be pretty different.
They have TVs in there that we're allowed to watch, you know, and they have newspapers and stuff. So you keep up with the current technology and what's going on in the world that way. But what really changes it for you, or what was the kind of eye opener for me, was the actions of the people, the way people talked, the way people dressed, the way people interact with one another.
Okay.
That was things that were markedly different.
In what sort of way?
Well, I was just actually speaking with my wife about some of this last night. So I can use some of this as an example. With the younger crowd and the dating scene in particular, you have something nowadays called Tinder, right?
Oh, Tinder gosh. App, yeah. Happy to say that I've never used it, but I have heard of it. Yeah.
Me either. No, but that being said, before I had left, you had to put in a little bit of work. There was a little bit of conversation, dating, taking out, spending money, you know, whichever. So seeing stuff like that blew my mind. And it, frankly, it still does today. I can't, the way that women in particular are just so quick to hook up with guys, like that was something that was totally different from what
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was. And then, you know, you come back to the old neighborhood and you see that the old neighborhood isn't the same anymore. They've either tore buildings down or they put new buildings up. One thing that was quite an eye opener though, and something that I learned a lesson from, is when I came home, I had friends, you know, before I had left. And so I thought, you know, oh, maybe I'll look some of my old friends up. Right. So anytime you've been gone that long, that's never a good idea. I don't think. I think that. It was only because the ones that were probably worth looking up, I couldn't find anymore because they didn't want anything to do with me and I didn't really blame them. And then the ones that I could find were in the same exact spot that I'd left them 10 years ago, living in their bedroom and their mother's house looked the same. I mean, they're dressing the same, everything. It was like I'd never left.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so the lesson for me at the time was when you take on that new life, you got to leave everything behind. And that,
yeah,
some of the old people too.
That's fair enough, man. So yeah. How did you meet your now wife?
Her and I have known each other since I was a teenager, or since
okay.
we were teenagers. Yeah. And so, we were never romantic with each other. Mm-hmm. It wasn't anything like that. That was more on me than anything else, mainly by my actions. I mean, I was a kid. I looked like a kid. I didn't really get into like physical development until I had mm-hmm. gone in. So, I mean, I was 6'4" and weighed about 195 pounds, you know, real, real thin, you know?
Gotcha.
Yeah. And it wasn't until later, because she'd come up to visit. She's also friends with my family too.
Yeah.
And so she had come up to visit with my grandmother, and there was just something about when we saw each other and we started talking, there was something there that wasn't there before.
I got you.
And I know everybody would think like, oh man, a guy's in there, you know, he hasn't been with a woman in this long and he's just must be dying for, you know, to tell you the honest to God truth. When I was doing my recovery and reading my self-help books, they all said, don't get in a relationship. So okay. my plan was not pursuing any type of relationship. So it was actually a curveball. It was something, I don't want to say it was unwanted, but it was something that I totally wasn't planning for or expecting to go towards.
Yeah. That's when these things happen, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
As soon as you decide, okay, I'm not going to get in a relationship, you know, they'll come along and catch you with you.
Yeah.
Catch you off guard.
Yeah. That's pretty much what it was too.
Okay. That's cool, man. So take us through the next couple of years then. So in terms of what you're doing now, the business you're working in, the kind of work you're doing.
The first couple of years coming home was tough. There was some ups and downs. I had to get used to stuff. Now, life is peaks and valleys, you know. So there was getting used to how society works, what my place was in it. One thing that I didn't have a problem with, and it was something that I really jumped in head first, was the work. I had told myself I was going to make it the whole time I was in there. I'm going to make it. So when I got into this line of work, I was working in an oil refinery.
Okay.
As a millwright. And when I got into this line of work, there's a lot of opportunities for overtime.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime overtime, hey, can somebody, I can stay. Hey, can somebody stay? I can stay. So gotcha. I was constantly like taking these overtime deals and just burying myself in work. My wife was doing well in work. We ended up doing well for ourselves and making money and saving and kind of deciding where we wanted our future to be. And mm-hmm. we realized that Southern California wasn't it. It was just kind of too crowded in the LA area. So we had gone on vacation to Northern California, to the Bay Area, not like San Francisco itself, but the outlying areas, and it was just this beautiful country, you know, Napa and these different nice areas that is just nice rolling hills and vineyards. And so we thought, wow, this would be a great place to raise our kids. So we put a plan into effect where we're like, we're going to move up there, and we did. And when that happened, you know, God. You probably heard the thing, just like we're talking about relationships, you know, you plan not to get into one and you get into one.
There's
a saying, you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans, right? So I had made sure that I had a job lined up for me up here. My wife made sure that she had a job for herself. Well, when we moved, she ended up getting a huge promotion, and we had wanted to make sure that our daughter was going to not be in... being brought up in daycare, that she was
okay.
gonna have a good education, because when we were in LA, she was a daycare baby. And so sure. it came to where we were able to, I was able to stop millwriting and get into other stuff and mm-hmm. stay home and do the homeschooling with my daughter. My wife was able to take her promotion, and she also helps with the homeschooling as well. But mm-hmm. we were able to kind of rearrange our lives to where we didn't have to have her in daycare, and we can homeschool her being my daughter.
And so, how old is she now?
She's 8.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So it's been a ride because nothing turned out exactly how I thought it would, but I wouldn't change anything. Like, it's all great.
Yeah.
So you just kind of learn to go with it, I guess. Just make sure you're doing the best you can do.
What more can anybody ask for, man?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, firstly, let me say congratulations, because
thank you.
It's an inspiring story, and I love hearing people turning bad situations into good, positive, and inspiring ones. I think, yeah, it's always I never get tired of hearing stories like that.
Me too.
Because what it just shows, whatever situation someone is in, mm-hmm. you can turn it around. If you've got the right, I think it all begins with the mind. You know, I'm very big on mindset, because yeah. I do think mindset is everything. You can put two people in the exact same situation, same circumstances, and depending on their mindset, they can come out completely differently.
I actually have a couple sentences in the book that's coming out, The Code, that are okay. Almost exactly what you just said.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I agree. And I'm saying that because I agree with you 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Absolutely.
I think it's a very empowering thing to hear, but some people seem to want to reject that message or push back against it. And I always find that a little bit bizarre, because I can't think of anything more empowering than the thought of, you know what, regardless of your starting point or what you've been through or what you've done, there is a way, which is on you, that you can set your brain, you can set your actions, and you can, whatever it is, you can overcome this. You can put yourself in a better situation. So yeah. I don't know why anyone would want to push back against that. I find it kind of weird.
Absolutely. And, yeah. and I will tell you this, the biggest, but hands down, I put a tweet like this out there the other day, but hands down, the biggest pushback that I see in self-development is accepting responsibility. Hands down.
It is. Yeah, absolutely.
By a mile. Yeah. And I mean, to the point to where I've had, this is a term I learned last year, free will atheism. Okay. I've had people actually hit me in the DMs mm-hmm. and it's with the idea that we don't have free will. We aren't responsible for our actions, because we have been shaped by everything around us. The idea of intersectionality comes into play with this as well.
So yeah.
Like,
so
like everything is shaping us constantly.
Yeah.
So therefore we could never be 100% responsible for our actions mm-hmm. because we've been shaped by something else.
So we should abolish prison.
Yeah.
And crime and law and everything else.
Well, check it out. It's funny that you say that, because one of the free will atheist guys that I talked to, that's exactly where his line of thinking was. And the thing is this guy teaches philosophy in prisons. So
really?
kind of an interesting take on that. But I think it's the most empowering, like you were saying, the most empowering thing. So we have two problems, right? And I can say, well, this is my problem, or I can say, this isn't my problem. Well, if I say something's my problem, then by the very definition of me defining it, I can fix it. Right. Because absolutely. It's mine. Right. Yeah. But if I say something, somebody else's problem, oh my God, you're going to make yourself schizophrenic that way, you know, because how can you ever solve anything? Everything's happening to you, you know,
you can't.
Yeah. So it's totally empowering. I totally agree with you. In The Code, I speak of mindset. There's a whole chapter developed in mindset.
Okay.
I break it down into three parts. There's the positive aspect. And mm-hmm. not positive in the sense to where like life is a Disney movie and, you know, everybody's happy and hugging hands or holding hands and stuff. Positive in the sense that you are positive in your success, that you will be successful and you're going to learn from your errors. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's that positive mindset to me. Education would be the learning from your errors. That's the next step. Educate yourself, learn from your mistakes and constantly make yourself better. And you do that through education. And then the last part of the mindset is the momentum, which is to keep the ball rolling. You don't stop. An example would be in ancient times, if you had a stream of water, the mm-hmm. ancients would refer to that water as living water. They called it such for a couple reasons. Number one, it moved. So it was like it was alive, right? The water was moving. Okay. And another reason why was because if the water was moving, it was probably good to drink because nothing's getting the chance to collect in it and whatever. So it was probably good drinking. The opposition of that would be stagnant water. That's where like you'll get mosquito larvae and all types of nasty stuff, right? So if you keep that momentum going, you're like that living water.
Okay.
Rolling, things are going to keep going. When you stop, you become stagnant. And being stagnant, whatever you are, is no good.
Yeah, I'm constantly reading, constantly talking to new people, taking in new info, and learning new skills. It's why, it's part of the reason I wanted to do this podcast, beyond just having the opportunity to talk to a broad range of cool people with inspiring stories, but also to learn how to do it. So, you know, it's a challenge. Like, this is the sixth or seventh one I'm recording now, but I'm already finding myself stuttering less and feeling more confident about doing it. And it's one of those things. Yeah, I'd been toying with the idea for a while. And then 2019, I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to reach out to all these people I follow on Twitter and who follow me and I have good conversations with online. Let's get them on Skype. Let's record it. Let's put it out there. And who knows how it will grow and who knows who will benefit from it and be inspired by it.
I can tell just by peeping your account that you're a hustler, man. I mean, you're trying to make things happen, and that's that type of mindset that you need. Not necessarily where you're trying to hustle in a good way or bad way, like being a hustler, but the mindset of staying moving. You want to learn, you want to move. You're not standing still, and that's the thing. Is if you stand still too long or you lose your momentum, you're gonna get run over. Life's gonna pass you by. People say the rat race or a race, it's very much like a race, and you got to keep up or it just goes on without you.
That's true. Everything always keeps moving. And if you're not progressing, I almost feel like you're regressing. Mm-hmm. It's actually quite hard to stay still.
Yeah.
In a lot of things. I mean, I use a lot of gym analogies, but as you know, as someone who works out, you know, if you stop training, it's not like you maintain everything that you've built up. It's like, no, over time, it slowly get weaker, slowly get a little flabbier, you know, like the muscle starts atrophying, the fat starts. Just to stay where you are, you've got to keep running. It's a little bit like a treadmill. And then you got to run faster if you want to actually make progress. Coming back a little bit to the thing you were talking about, was it the free will atheist, you said? That's called determinism, right?
I guess so, it would be. I hadn't heard the term
free will
atheism before. Like, that was something I learned in 2018 to where I was going, wow, that's a thing.
Okay.
And the guy was explaining it to me. There was actually, he shot me a link, so I suppose any of you listening could look it up as well. Somebody did a TED Talk on it. Like, there was a TED Talk on free will atheism and how we're responsible for everybody else's actions. And oh my goodness.
Yeah. It's a bit of a bizarre concept. I have heard about it. And, you know, there's a lot of super intelligent people who believe in determinism rather than free will. So determinism is, everything is already determined and it's not. The way I understand it, it does boil down to you are not responsible for your own actions and outcomes. And I can't think of you can do all the intellectual backflips masturbation around it that you want to do. But at the end of the day, that's not a useful philosophy for yourself or for anybody else, because number one, you're unlikely to pursue big goals and achieve them if you do believe that your life is just on a track, especially if you're from some kind of underprivileged background or difficult background, right? It's easy to just go, screw it. Like, it wasn't meant for me to be successful. So I can't think of a worse message to give to someone like that. And then also, secondly, the way you treat other people, if you treat somebody as if they do not have free will, you're not going to have a good relationship with that person for very long.
Right.
As we're sitting here having this conversation it's based on the idea that you have free will and I have free will. If I just look at you like you're some kind of robot who's not actually in charge of every word that comes out your mouth, you're not really... it's not really your own free thought. That was just your background and your experience and, you know, your intersectionality. It's like, what a terrible way to view the world. That's what I think anyway. That's my personal opinion.
It's one of those ones. It's like a depressing way to view the world almost. And here's, if I can expound on this, just this is why I think so.
Okay.
I think that, and this is going to sound kind of like it's in juxtaposition of each other, but I believe that your problems and suffering breed happiness.
Yes.
Okay. I believe that the more you battle, mm-hmm. the happier you are or you become.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the absence of strife, difficulties, problems, whatever you want to, we have come in the society, we strive to make everything more attainable through ease, right? So now you don't need to go to the grocery store because the grocery store delivers their food to you, right? They made it easier for you, right? Our whole society is set up like that, to where we're just trying to make things easier. That's why everybody's so depressed.
I had this conversation with my girlfriend literally 2 or 3 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Do you follow Jordan Peterson's work at all?
I to some degree.
Yeah. Well, one of his big core messages is the meaning of life and actual happiness and fulfillment. Let's say fulfillment more than happiness. Sure. That actually comes from bearing a load and carrying it. So if you think of what it is that makes you feel fulfilled, makes you feel like you're progressing, it's all connected to taking on more responsibility.
Yes.
So whether you're talking about relationships, you're talking about marriage, you're talking about becoming a father, I'm not a father myself, but each of those things, that's taking on more responsibility, getting a job, getting a promotion, building a business, these are all taking on more responsibility willingly.
Oh yeah.
And so his answer to people who are, I guess, feeling lost or feeling depressed or feeling anxious, it's actually pick up a big weight metaphorically and mm-hmm. carry it, and that will give your life meaning.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the danger, as you're saying, with making everything too easy and too comfortable, you then people have nothing to strive for. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, depression is a modern Western phenomenon, really, something that people deal with in the developed world. If you go to places where people are still struggling to satisfy the basic needs, depression, as far as I'm aware, it's not a thing there. People don't talk about depression.
They don't have time for it.
No, because your mission is already there, right? Your mission is survival. So okay, we gotta eat, we gotta go get the food, we gotta go get the water, we've gotta work, we've gotta do this, we've gotta tend to the land, we've gotta tend to the animals. Like your mission is there. There's nothing to think about, right? If all those things are already satisfied, you've got a roof over your head, you've got running water, you've got food, you can just access stuff at a click of a button. You then need to actually create your own thing.
Yeah.
Right. You have to think about that. You have to consciously think, okay, like what can I do to make my life more difficult almost? Right. Which sounds a bit bizarre, but I think what it is.
You know what a good example of that you see with people and their children? I'll tell you something. My grandfather owned an aviation business. I grew up learning, I knew how to fly airplanes, and they refer to them as STOL aircraft, which stands for short takeoff and landing. These are usually like the Cessnas, Beechcraft, you know, small planes that have like a single or maybe two props, you know, but not like jets or anything big. Right. So I grew up flying those planes with them. But my grandfather was an extremely hard man.
Okay.
Hard man. Like the most hardcore man I have ever met in my life. Okay. Women loved him because he was like James Bond with the ladies, you know. So you ask any women and they're like, oh, he was so great and this and that, but he was a completely different person around men. Okay. So he was totally hardcore dude. Built this business for himself, came back from the war, became, you know, he was a pilot for American Airlines, then he started his own business, built the stuff up, bought himself a vacation house, had his other houses. Made something for himself, right? Because he took on the responsibilities, took on more responsibilities, had the burden, like you're talking about, and made something for himself. His two sons, because my father had died, and they had another son, which had also died. As a matter of fact, my father and my uncle died 6 months from each other. So, I mean,
it was damn.
Hard life on him and my grandmother, right?
Yeah.
But the two remaining kids, to this day, are just drunks and drug addicts.
Mm.
Nothing. Why?
Yeah.
Because they didn't have to do anything. They had it. There was no struggle where they were going to be put out. There was nothing for them ever to where it was like, if you don't do this, you aren't going to eat.
Yeah.
Like you're going to, and so what happens? And that this story isn't unique. I've seen that so many times with either friends of mine or people that I knew that were around my age that had these parents that were wealthy, you know, mm-hmm. and they were usually either immigrants or like some other thing where they came from somewhere and just worked their butt off. Right. Yeah. And then the kids were just dope fiends. Didn't do anything.
Mm.
You know, they're to this day, 40 years old and still living at home, you know, to where it's like, 'cause they had no struggle. There was nothing.
No.
People may not like me for saying this, but when we were talking about depression earlier, I believe that the symptoms that people are experiencing from depression, and I guess in a sense, the diagnosis itself can be real. I also believe that depression is a disease for people that can afford it.
Yeah, I know. I understand what you mean completely.
Because if you're hard up, you can't afford to be depressed. You got work to do.
Yeah.
So it's, and I know many may not agree with that, but
it's one of those topics where people understandably, you know, can get a little bit touchy. And it seems like there's certain politically correct views and non-politically correct views. But
sure.
I think if you go by all the PC ones on that, I think you can actually cause people more harm in the long term and in the grand scheme of things. Rather than, again, we were talking, spending a lot of time talking about personal responsibility. So if you make it too easy for people to just say, oh, you know what, it's not me, it's the depression. If you just categorize it as a disease and say it's some ailment and it's something that's affecting you rather than something that you are able to affect, then I think that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm no expert on this matter. Right. So if someone is listening to this and you're like, no, you're completely wrong and you want to come on and talk to me about it, I'm happy to have that conversation. But like one of my previous guests was saying, you know, he was saying he does not believe in depression. He thinks it's like a ghost. So
was that Tate?
That's Tate, right? Yeah. So him not believing in it, that mm-hmm. means that he can't even be impacted by it. Just like if you don't believe in ghosts, you can't think your house is haunted and you cannot be afraid of ghosts because you do not believe in them. So yeah. Like I was saying to him, whether that is scientifically, biologically, whatever, whether that's right or wrong, that is an empowering belief because it will insulate you from it. You're not going to, even if you're feeling down, even if you're feeling negative, you will recognize that and you'll be like, okay, I need to take certain steps. I need to work out certain things in my life. I need to work out why I'm in this state and I need to take action to improve it rather than trying to take something external like a drug or, you know, certain types of therapy or whatever that may not help it. But, you know, as I said, I'm open to different opinions. If someone's got a different opinion on that, then you're always welcome to hit me up, send me a message, and maybe we'll get you on the podcast as well.
My wife is in the medical profession and
okay.
And from her training, mm-hmm. she may have a different opinion than you or I may have, you know.
Sure.
But we're speaking of depression, but that the same rule of thought that you were just speaking of can apply to so many different spectrums. I said something earlier. I actually tweeted out something. I'm going to paraphrase because it's not in front of me, but it said mental health is a spectrum. People don't mm-hmm. like to think that. People like
oh yeah
to
yeah
think like either you have mental health issues or you're fine. Like, it's either black or white, to where it's a lot like autism where they say like autism is a spectrum, you know, mm-hmm. to where, you know, some people are just a little bit more mentally fit than others. I believe that too. And I believe that the way that you get there is through the accepting responsibility, because you can put so many different, that's my OCD. Oh, that's my bipolar. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I didn't mean to say all those mean and hurtful things to you, but you know that I deal with that bipolar, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry because it's something else. It's not me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think whenever you start doing that with anything,
mm-hmm.
again, I just think it's regardless of the level of truth that there may or may not be, I just don't think it's useful. I don't think it's useful. I don't think there's any use in telling people, okay, you're, I don't know, take someone who is from an underprivileged background. you don't help and empower them by just telling them nothing is your fault, nothing is your responsibility, nothing's your accountability. It's not saying that you are to blame for the situation. Obviously not. People don't choose where they're born or what conditions they're born into. Right. However, regardless, it's your life. Mm-hmm. And you're ultimately, no matter what, you can point at whoever, but ultimately you're going to be responsible for your own actions, your reactions to the things that happen to you or near you, and the way that you deal with that, and to some degree your outcome. I mean, given enough time, maybe not in 3 years' time, but if you live for 80 years, certainly if you're born, say, in the Western world, okay, mm-hmm. and somewhere with tons of opportunities, no question. Mm-hmm. Certainly comparatively, you know, maybe where you are in 5 years' time, that's not going to be completely up to you. But over the course of your entire lifespan, there's so much opportunity out there that I don't buy the argument that even if you started out in a crap situation, I understand that's rough. Certain things will be harder for you. But given 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, yeah. you can put yourself in a much better position. Oh, and so many millions of people have done that. That's not just my personal opinion. That's like a fact. People can do it. So if other people can do it, the next person can do it. It's not saying it's easy, but it can be done.
This is how people can be behind prison walls and say that they're free. Okay. Free on the inside. Okay. By accepting what could be more pleasing than saying, hey, you got to go sit in the back of the car or the bus, right? Or you get the keys and you could be the driver. Mm-hmm. Okay. One saying, hey, you go sit in the back of the plane by the tail, or the other one, you could be the pilot.
Yeah.
For me, it is so liberating, and it was the way that I was able to be free while in there, was the fact that I did have a choice and was responsible for everything, even mm-hmm. while I was in there.
Yeah. Right?
Who I chose to interact with, how I interacted with them, any and all. It's on you. There's nobody in there puppeting or pulling the strings. And it is such a liberating, freeing experience once you go, you know what? It's not other people's fault, man. This is me. I'm doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally.
And I wanted to ask actually, when you were inside, what books did you find that really helped you? Were there any particular books that helped you shape how your mindset is now?
Yeah, I would say if there's anybody out there that's like seriously wanting to change their outlook, but they are also the type of person that's like data driven and more fact driven than they are feeling driven. Mm-hmm. There's a book. This guy was a psychiatrist, so he had an MD, and he was a doctor in the military before he started his own psychiatric practice. He's no longer living, but his name was M. Scott Peck. And the book that he wrote was called The Road Less Traveled. When people ask me if there was any particular book or whatever that had a shift on my thinking or really helped, that's always the one that I let them know. The Road Less Traveled, M. Scott Peck.
Okay. I haven't read that myself, so I will have to check that out.
It's a great book.
Okay. I'll definitely have to check that out.
And like I said, he's a doctor, so when he's trying to explain things to you, it's not like he's coming from a place to where he's like, well, I feel like this, or I think that he's coming, he's breaking everything down, even on biological levels sometimes, where you're like, oh, wow. Okay. So great book.
Okay. Awesome, man. And okay. So what is next for Bobby Dino? You've got your book coming out. What's it called? And what's the plan for that?
Okay. So the book is called The Code, A Guide to Masculinity and Awareness is the cover behind me. That is going to be released on February 15th.
Okay.
As the subtitle suggests, it's a guide not to masculinity and necessarily the sense of how do I be a man so I can go take over other men. Mm-hmm. It's a guide in the sense of, what if there's people out there that are like me, that didn't have the father growing up? Because I know there's a bunch.
Yeah.
That didn't have the father growing up, that didn't have a good male role model in their lives to kind of break stuff down to them and tell them, hey, you know what? this is what you need to do. This is how you should get that. This is how you should think. That's who I wrote this book for. Okay. I wrote it for people that A, didn't have someone to tell them, and B, there's a section in the book on situational awareness and because that's also the other part of the subtitle is the self-awareness. And it's also for the people that may not know how to present themselves to the world.
Okay.
People that like if you're the type of person to where maybe you don't like to go to parties because you don't want to have to talk to people, or maybe when you're around a group of people, you kind of like to go and stand off the side, or you get those anxious feelings or are they looking at me, or you're afraid even to go out. It's for you. This book is so that you can be confident when you step out the front door that you're being a good man and you don't have to worry about anything.
Well, that sounds very positive.
Cool.
That sounds very positive. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this who will appreciate that. So that is The Code, A Guide to Masculinity and Self-Awareness. And that's February 15th.
February 15th. And you'll be able to find that on my website. And it's real easy to remember, bobbydino.com.
Boom. Easy. And where can people find you on Twitter?
Twitter handle is Real Bobby Dino.
So that is Real Bobby. That's Dino, D-I-N-O, for anyone listening. Yeah.
Yeah. Correct.
Awesome, man. It's been really good to talk to you, Bobby. Your story is very inspiring. I will continue to follow. We will continue to talk. And it's been great to have you. No doubt, man. We'll definitely get you on here again in the future.
Okay. Right on, man.
Nice one, man. Have a good one.
You too.
With the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.